In the span of a few hours, before Kaufman's eyes, Wright sketched out a detailed design. Kaufman had commissioned a weekend cottage at one of his family's favorite picnic spots, where they could see a waterfall. Wright had a radically different idea in mind. He drew the house on a rock on top of the waterfall, which would be out of sight from the house. He convinced Kaufman to accept it, and eventually charged him $125,000 for it, more than triple the $35,000 specified in the contract. It's unlikely that a giver would have ever been comfortable deviating so far from a client's expectations, let alone convincing him to endorse it enthusiastically and charging extra for it. It was a taker's mindset, it seems, that gave Wright the gall to develop a truly original vision and to sell it to a client. But the very same taker tendencies that served Wright well in Falling Water also precipitated his 9-year slump. For 2 decades, until 1911, Wright made his name as an architect living in Chicago and Oak Park, Illinois, where he benefited from the assistance of craftspeople and sculptors. In 1911, he designed Taliesin, an estate in a remote Wisconsin valley. Believing he could excel alone, he moved out there. But as time passed, Wright spun his wheels during long years of enforced idleness, Gill wrote. At Taliesin, Wright lacked access to talented apprentices. The isolation he chose by creating Taliesin, D. St. Aubin observes, left him without the elements that had become essential to his life, architectural commissions and skillful workers to help him complete his building designs. Frank Lloyd Wright's drought lasted until he gave up on independence and began to work interdependently again with talented collaborators. It wasn't his own idea. His wife, Ogivana, convinced him to start a fellowship for apprentices to help him with his work. When apprentices joined him in 1932, his productivity soared, and he was soon working on the Falling Water House, which would be seen by many as the greatest work of architecture in modern history. Wright ran his fellowship program for a quarter century, but even then, he struggled to appreciate how much he depended on apprentices. He refused to pay apprentices, requiring them to do cooking, cleaning, and fieldwork. Wright was a great architect, explained his former apprentice, Edgar Toffel, who worked on Falling Water. But he needed people like myself to make his designs work, although you couldn't tell him that. Wright's story exposes the gap between our natural tendencies to attribute creative success to individuals and the collaborative reality that underpins much truly great work. This gap isn't limited to strictly creative fields. Even in seemingly independent jobs that rely on raw brain power, our success depends more on others than we realize. For the past decade, several Harvard professors have studied cardiac surgeons in hospitals and security analysts in investment banks. Both groups specialize in knowledge work. They need serious smarts to rewire patients' hearts and organize complex information for stock recommendations. According to management guru Peter Drucker, these knowledge workers, unlike manual workers in manufacturing, own the means of production. They carry that knowledge in their heads and can therefore take it with them. But carrying knowledge isn't actually so easy. In one study, professors Robert Huckman and Gary Pisano wanted to know whether surgeons get better with practice. Since surgeons are in high demand, they perform procedures at multiple hospitals. Over a 2-year period, Huckman and Pisano tracked 38,577 procedures performed by 203 cardiac surgeons at 43 different hospitals. They focused on coronary artery bypass grafts, where surgeons open a patient's chest and attach a vein from a leg or a section of chest artery to bypass a blockage in an artery to the heart. On average, 3% of patients died during these procedures. When Huckman and Pisano examined the data, they discovered a remarkable pattern. Overall, the surgeons didn't get better with practice. They only got better at the specific hospital where they practiced. For every procedure they handled at a given hospital, the risk of patient mortality dropped by 1%. But the risk of mortality stayed the same at other hospitals. The surgeons couldn't take their performance with them. They weren't getting better at performing coronary artery bypass grafts. They were becoming more familiar with particular nurses and anesthesiologists, learning about their strengths and weaknesses, habits, and styles. This familiarity helped them avoid patient deaths, but it didn't carry over to other hospitals. To reduce the risk of patient mortality, the surgeons needed relationships with specific surgical team members. While Huckman and Pisano were collecting their hospital data, down the hall at Harvard, a similar study was underway in the financial sector. In investment banks, security analysts conduct research to produce earnings forecasts and make recommendations to money management firms about whether to buy or sell a company's stock. Star analysts carry superior knowledge and expertise that they should be able to use regardless of who their colleagues are. As investment research executive Fred Frankel explains, analysts are one of the most mobile Wall Street professions because their expertise is portable. I mean, you've got it when you're here, and you've got it when you're there. The client base doesn't change. You need your Rolodex and your files, and you're in business. To test this assumption, Boris Groysberg studied more than 1,000 equity and fixed income security analysts over a 9-year period at 78 different firms. The analysts were ranked in effectiveness by thousands of clients at investment management institutions based on the quality of their earnings estimates, industry knowledge, written reports, service, stock selection, and accessibility and responsiveness. The top three analysts in each of 80 industry sectors were ranked as stars, earning between $2 million and $5 million. Groysberg and his colleagues tracked what happened when the analysts switched firms. Over the 9-year period, 366 analysts, 9%, moved, so it was possible to see whether the stars maintained their success in new firms. Even though they were supposed to be individual stars, their performance wasn't portable. When star analysts moved to a different firm, their performance dropped, and it stayed lower for at least 5 years. In the first year after the move, the star analysts were 5% less likely to be ranked first, 6% less likely to be ranked second, 1% less likely to be ranked third, and 6% more likely to be unranked. Even 5 years after the move, the stars were 5% less likely to be ranked first and 8% more likely to be unranked. On average, firms lost about $24 million by hiring star analysts. Contrary to the beliefs of Frankel and other industry insiders, Groysberg and his colleagues conclude that hiring stars is advantageous neither to stars themselves in terms of their performance, nor to hiring companies in terms of their market value. But some of the star analysts did maintain their success. If they moved with their teams, the stars showed no decline at all in performance. The star analysts who moved solo had a 5% probability of being ranked first, while the star analysts who moved with teammates had a 10% probability of being ranked first. The same as those who didn't move at all. In another study, Groysberg and his colleagues found that analysts were more likely to maintain their star performance if they worked with high-quality colleagues in their teams and departments. The star analysts relied on knowledgeable colleagues for information and new ideas. The star investment analysts and the cardiac surgeons depended heavily on collaborators who knew them well or had strong skills of their own. If Frank Lloyd Wright had been more of a giver than a taker, could he have avoided the 9 years in which his income and reputation plummeted? George Meyer thinks so. I wish I could hate you. After Meyer left Saturday Night Live in 1987, he hightailed it out of New York City and moved to Boulder, Colorado, to work on the Letterman movie script alone. Just like Frank Lloyd Wright, Meyer had isolated himself from his collaborators. But in stark contrast to Wright, Meyer recognized that he needed other people to succeed. He knew his performance was interdependent, not independent. His ability to make people laugh was due in part to collaborating with fellow comedy writers. So he reached out to people who had worked with him at the Lampoon and on his past shows, inviting them to contribute to Army Man. "I believe that collaboration is such a beautiful thing, especially in comedy," Meyer told me. "In a community of funny people, you can get that rare synergy, jokes you could never have come up with on your own." Four colleagues ended up helping Meyer with the inaugural issue. One of those colleagues was Jack Handy, who contributed an early installment of Deep Thoughts, which went on to become a wildly popular series of jokes. Meyer published Deep Thoughts 3 years before they became famous on Saturday Night Live, and they contributed to the success of Army Man. The juxtaposition of George Meyer with Frank Lloyd Wright reveals how givers and takers think differently about success. Wright thought he could take his architectural genius from Chicago, where he worked with a team of experts, to a remote part of Wisconsin, where he was largely alone. Wright's family motto was, "Truth against the world," and it's a familiar theme in Western culture. We tend to privilege the lone genius who generates ideas that enthrall us or change our world. According to research by a trio of Stanford psychologists, Americans see independence as a symbol of strength, viewing interdependence as a sign of weakness. This is particularly true of takers, who tend to see themselves as superior to and separate from others. If they depend too much on others, takers believe, they'll be vulnerable to being outdone. Like Wright, the star analyst who left their investment banks without their successful teams or without considering the quality of the new teams they were joining, fell into this trap. Givers reject the notion that interdependence is weak. Givers are more likely to see interdependence as a source of strength, a way to harness the skills of multiple people for a greater good. This appreciation of interdependence heavily influenced the way that Meyer collaborated. He recognized that if he could contribute effectively to the group, everyone would be better off. So he went out of his way to support his colleagues. When Meyer wrote for Saturday Night Live in the mid-1980s, as a virtual unknown, he was almost always in the office, making himself available to give feedback. He ended up helping famous comedians like John Lovitz, Phil Hartman, and Randy Quaid with their writing and delivery. Behind the scenes on Saturday Night Live, many writers were competing to get their sketches on the show. "There was a Darwinian element," Meyer admits. "There might be 10 sketches per show, and we would have 35 or 40 sketches on the table. There was a bit of a battle, and I just tried to be a good collaborator." When big stars like Madonna were slated to appear on the show, his colleagues flocked to submit sketches. Meyer submitted material for those shows, but he also put in extra effort on sketches for less electric guests, who tended to attract fewer sketches. Meyer took it upon himself to develop compelling sketches for less glamorous guests, like Jimmy Breslin, because that was where the show needed him most. "I just wanted to be a good soldier," Meyer says. "When people weren't as excited, that's when I felt I had to step up my game." He rose to the occasion, co-writing a hilarious sketch for Breslin that had James Bond villains on a talk show. Breslin played Goldfinger, offering tips on designing fortresses, and griping about having his schemes thwarted by Bond. The sketch predated the hit Austin Powers spoof of Bond movies by more than a decade. Meyer's pattern of giving continued on The Simpsons. Among writers, the most popular task was typically to write the first draft of an episode, as it allowed them to put their creative stamp on it. Meyer would generate plenty of ideas for episodes, but he rarely wrote the first draft. Instead, feeling that his skills were needed more in rewriting, he took responsibility for the dirty work of spending months helping to rewrite and revise each episode. This is a defining feature of how givers collaborate. They take on the tasks that are in the group's best interest, not necessarily their own personal interests. This makes their groups better off. Studies show that on average, from sales teams to paper mill crews to restaurants, the more giving group members do, the higher the quantity and quality of their group's products and services. But it's not just their groups that get rewarded. Like Adam Rifkin, successful givers expand the pie in ways that benefit themselves as well as their groups. Extensive research reveals that people who give their time and knowledge regularly to help their colleagues earn more raises and promotions in a wide range of settings, from banks to manufacturing companies. On The Simpsons, I think George surrendered himself to the show, Tim Long says. Intuitively, he understood that the best thing for him was for the show to be as good as possible. There's a name for Meyer's actions. In the world of mountaineering, it's called expedition behavior. The term was coined by the National Outdoor Leadership School, NOLS, which has provided wilderness education to thousands of people, including crews of NASA astronauts. Expedition behavior involves putting the group's goals and mission first, and showing the same amount of concern for others as you do for yourself. Jeff Ashby, a NASA space shuttle commander who has flown more than 400 orbits around Earth, says that expedition behavior, being selfless, generous, and putting the team ahead of yourself, is what helps us succeed in space more than anything else. John Canongater, who directs leadership at NOLS, adds that expedition behavior is not a zero-sum game. When you give it away, you gain more in response. Part of Meyer's success came from expanding the pie. The more he contributed to the success of his shows, the more success there was for the whole team to share. But Meyer's expedition behavior also changed the way his colleagues saw him. When givers put a group's interest ahead of their own, they signal that their primary goal is to benefit the group. As a result, givers earn the respect of their collaborators. If Meyer had competed to draft his strongest sketches for Madonna, his fellow writers might have viewed him as a threat to their own status and careers. By doing his best work for less coveted guests, Meyer was doing his colleagues a favor. Takers no longer felt that they needed to compete with him. Matchers felt they owed him, and givers saw him as one of them. When you were breaking your story or rewriting your script in the room, George was always a welcome addition to the group, says Don Payne, a Simpsons writer since 1998. He would always come up with something that would make your scripts better. That's what draws people to him. They respect and admire him. In addition to building goodwill, volunteering for unpopular tasks, and offering feedback, gave Meyer the chance to demonstrate his comedic gifts without leading colleagues to feel insecure. In one study, University of Minnesota researchers Eugene Kim and Teresa Glum found that highly talented people tend to make others jealous, placing themselves at risk of being disliked, resented, ostracized, and undermined. But if these talented people are also givers, they no longer have a target on their backs. Instead, givers are appreciated for their contributions to the group. By taking on tasks that his colleagues didn't want, Meyer was able to dazzle them with his wit and humor without eliciting envy. Meyer summarizes his code of honor as 1. Show up. 2. Work hard. 3. Be kind. 4. Take the high road. As he gave in ways that revealed his skills without spawning jealousy, colleagues began to admire and trust his comedic genius. People started to see him as somebody who wasn't just motivated personally, Tim Long explains. You don't think of him as a competitor. He's someone you can think of on a higher plane and can trust creatively. Carolyn Omine adds, compared to other writers' rooms I've been in, I would say The Simpsons tends to look longer for jokes. I think it's because we have writers like George who will say, no, that's not quite right, even if it's late, even if we're all tired. I think that's an important quality. We need those people, like George, who aren't afraid to say, no, this isn't good enough. We can do better. In a classic article, the psychologist Edwin Hollander argued that when people act generously in groups, they earn idiosyncrasy credits, positive impressions that accumulate in the minds of group members. Since many people think like matchers when they work in groups, it's very common for them to keep track of each member's credits and debits. Once a group member earns idiosyncrasy credits through giving, matchers grant that member a license to deviate from a group's norms or expectations. As Berkeley sociologist Rob Willer summarizes, groups reward individual sacrifice. On The Simpsons, Meyer amassed plenty of idiosyncrasy credits, earning latitude to contribute original ideas and shift the creative direction of the show. One of the best things about developing that credibility was if I wanted to try something that was fairly strange, people would be willing to at least give it a shot at the table read, Meyer reflects. They ended up not rewriting my stuff as much as they had early on because they knew I had a decent track record. I think people saw that my heart was in the right place. My intentions were good. That goes a long way. In line with Meyer's experience, research shows that givers get extra credit when they offer ideas that challenge the status quo. In studies that I conducted with colleagues Sharon Parker and Catherine Collins, when takers presented suggestions for improvement, colleagues were skeptical of their intentions, writing them off as self-serving. But when ideas that might be threatening were proposed by givers, their colleagues listened and rewarded them for speaking up, knowing they were motivated by a genuine desire to contribute. When I think about George in a writer's room, nice is not what I would say. He's spicier than that, Carolyn Omine laughs. But when George is tough, you know it is only because he cares so much about getting it right. In 1995, during the 6th Simpsons season, Meyer told his colleagues he would be leaving the show at the end of the season. Rather than seeing his departure as an opportunity for personal advancement, the writers didn't want to let him go. They quickly joined forces to recruit him back, persuading him to return as a consultant. Soon they had him all the way back as a full-time writer. At a very early point, they realized that George was too important to let out of the room, John Vitti told the Harvard Crimson. Nobody's opinion is more valued than George's. Looking back on his experiences working with Meyer, Tim Long adds that there's something magical about getting the reputation as someone who cares about others more than yourself. It redounds to your benefit in countless ways. Claiming the lion's share of the credit. Although Meyer's giving strengthened his reputation in the inner circles of show business, he toiled in anonymity in the outside world. In Hollywood, there's an easy solution to this problem. Writers gain prominence by claiming credits on as many television episodes as possible, which proves that the ideas and scenes were their brainchild. George Meyer shaped and sculpted more than 300 Simpsons episodes. But in quiet defiance of Hollywood norms, he's only credited as a writer on 12 of them. On hundreds of episodes, other writers got the credit for Meyer's ideas and jokes. George never took writing credits on The Simpsons, even though he was an idea machine, Tim Long told me. People tend to come up with ideas and jealously guard them, but George would create ideas, give them to someone else, and never take credit. There's a crucial stretch of The Simpsons over 10 years where he's not credited with a single joke, even though he was responsible for a huge number of them. By giving away credit, Meyer compromised his visibility. For a long time, George's towering contribution to what we see as the most important TV show of the period was not as well known as it should have been, Long recalls. He was generating a tremendous amount of material and not really getting credit. Should Meyer have claimed more credit for his efforts? Hogging credit certainly seemed to work for Frank Lloyd Wright. At Taliesin, Wright insisted that his name be on every document as head architect, even when apprentices took the lead on a project. He threatened his apprentices that if they didn't credit him first and submit all documents for his approval, he would accuse them of forgery and take them to court. Yet if we take a closer look at Meyer's experience, we might draw the conclusion that when Wright had success as an architect, it was in spite of taking credit, not because of it. Meyer's reluctance to take credit might have cost him some fame in the short run, but he wasn't worried about it. He earned credit as an executive producer, landing a half dozen Emmys for his work on The Simpsons, and felt there was plenty of credit to go around. A lot of people feel they're diminished if there are too many names on a script, like everybody's trying to share a dog bowl, Meyer says. But that's not really the way it works. The thing about credit is that it's not zero sum. There's room for everybody, and you'll shine if other people are shining. Time would prove Meyer right. Despite his short-term sacrifices, Meyer ended up receiving the credit he deserved. Meyer was virtually unknown outside of Hollywood until 2000, when David Owen published his profile in The New Yorker, with the headline describing Meyer as the funniest man behind the funniest show on TV. When Owen contacted key Simpsons writers for interviews, they jumped at the chance to sing Meyer's praises. As Tim Long puts it, "It makes me incredibly happy to extol George's virtues, even if I'm going to embarrass him." Just as matchers grant a bonus to givers in collaborations, they impose a tax on the takers. In a study of Slovenian companies led by Mate Cerny, employees who hid knowledge from their co-workers struggled to generate creative ideas because their co-workers responded in kind, refusing to share information with them. To illustrate, consider the career of the medical researcher Jonas Salk, who began working to develop a polio vaccine in 1948. The following year, scientists John Enders, Frederick Robbins, and Thomas Weller successfully grew the polio virus in test tubes, paving the way for mass producing a vaccine based on a live virus. By 1952, Salk's research lab at the University of Pittsburgh had developed a vaccine that appeared to be effective. That year witnessed the worst polio epidemic in U.S. history. The virus infected more than 57,000 people, leading to more than 3,000 deaths and 20,000 cases of paralysis. Over the next 3 years, Salk's mentor, Thomas Francis, directed the evaluation of a field trial of the Salk vaccine, testing it on more than 1.8 million children with the help of 220,000 volunteers, 64,000 school workers, and 20,000 healthcare professionals. On April 12, 1955, in Ann Arbor, Michigan, Francis made an announcement that sent a ripple of hope throughout the country. The Salk vaccine was safe, effective, and potent. Within 2 years, the vaccine was disseminated through the Herculean efforts of the March of Dimes and the incidence of polio fell by nearly 90%. By 1961, there were just 161 cases in the United States. The vaccine had similar effects worldwide. Jonas Salk became an international hero. But at the historic 1955 press conference, Salk gave a valedictory speech that jeopardized his relationships and his reputation in the scientific community. He didn't acknowledge the important contributions of Enders, Robbins, and Weller, who had won a Nobel Prize a year earlier for their groundbreaking work that enabled Salk's team to produce the vaccine. Even more disconcertingly, Salk gave no credit to the six researchers in his lab who were major contributors to his efforts to develop the vaccine: Byron Bennett, Percival Baisley, L. James Lewis, Julius Jungner, Elsie Ward, and Francis Yurochko. Salk's team left the press conference in tears. As historian David Ashensky writes in Polio, An American Story, Salk never acknowledged the people in his own lab. This group, seated proudly together in the packed auditorium, would feel painfully snubbed. Salk's co-workers from Pittsburgh had come expecting to be honored by their boss. A tribute seemed essential and long overdue. This was especially true from a matcher's perspective. One colleague told a reporter, "At the beginning, I saw him as a father figure. And at the end, an evil father figure." Over time, it became clear that Julius Jungner felt particularly slighted. "Everybody likes to get credit for what they've done," Jungner told Ashensky. "It was a big shock." The snub fractured their relationship. Jungner left Salk's lab in 1957 and went on to make a number of important contributions to virology and immunology. In 1993, they finally crossed paths at the University of Pittsburgh, and Jungner shared his feelings. "We were in the audience, your closest colleagues and devoted associates who worked hard and faithfully for the same goal that you desired," Jungner began. "Do you remember whom you mentioned and whom you left out? Do you realize how devastated we were at that moment and ever afterward when you persisted in making your co-workers invisible?" Jungner reflected that Salk was clearly shaken by these memories and offered little response. Jonas Salk's moment of taking sole credit haunted him for the rest of his career. He launched the Salk Institute for Biological Studies, where hundreds of researchers continue to push the envelope of humanitarian science today. But Salk's own productivity waned. Later in his career, he tried unsuccessfully to develop an AIDS vaccine, and he was shunned by his colleagues. He never won a Nobel Prize, and he was never elected to the prestigious National Academy of Sciences. In the coming years, almost every prominent polio researcher would gain entrance, Ashensky writes. The main exception, of course, was Jonas Salk. As one observer put it, Salk had broken the unwritten commandments of scientific research, which included, "Thou shalt give credit to others." According to Jungner, people really held it against him that he had grandstanded like that and really done the most uncollegial thing that you can imagine. Salk thought his colleagues were jealous. If someone does something and gets credit for it, then there is this tendency to have this competitive response, he acknowledged in rare comments about the incident. "I was not unscathed by Ann Arbor." But Salk passed away in 1995 without ever acknowledging the contributions of his colleagues. 10 years later, in 2005, the University of Pittsburgh held an event to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the vaccine announcement. With Jungner in attendance, Salk's son, AIDS researcher Peter Salk, finally set the record straight. It was not the accomplishment of one man. It was the accomplishment of a dedicated and skilled team, Peter Salk said. This was a collaborative effort. It appears that Jonas Salk made the same mistake as Frank Lloyd Wright. He saw himself as independent rather than interdependent. Instead of earning the idiosyncrasy credits that George Meyer attained, Salk was penalized by his colleagues for taking sole credit. Why didn't Salk ever credit the contributions of his colleagues to the development of the polio vaccine? It's possible that he was jealously guarding his own accomplishments, as a taker would naturally do. But I believe there's a more convincing answer. He didn't feel they deserved credit. Why would that be? The responsibility bias. To understand this puzzle, we need to take a trip to Canada, where psychologists have been asking married couples to put their relationships on the line. Think about your marriage or your most recent romantic relationship. Of the total effort that goes into the relationship, from making dinner and planning dates to taking out the garbage and resolving conflicts, what percentage of the work do you handle? Let's say you claim responsibility for 55% of the total effort in the relationship. If you're perfectly calibrated, your partner will claim responsibility for 45%, and your estimates will add up to 100%. In actuality, psychologist Michael Ross and Fiore Sicoli found that 3 out of every 4 couples add up to significantly more than 100%. Partners overestimate their own contributions. This is known as the responsibility bias, exaggerating our own contributions relative to others' inputs. It's a mistake to which takers are especially vulnerable, and it's partially driven by the desire to see and present ourselves positively. In line with this idea, Jonas Salk certainly didn't avoid the spotlight. One of his great gifts, Oshinsky writes, was a knack for putting himself forward in a manner that made him seem genuinely indifferent to his fame. Reporters and photographers would always find Salk grudging but available. He would warn them not to waste too much of his time. He would grouse about the important work they were keeping him from doing, and then, having lodged his formulaic protest, he would fully accommodate. But there's another factor at play that's both more powerful and more flattering. Information discrepancy. We have more access to information about our own contributions than the contributions of others. We see all of our own efforts, but we only witness a subset of our partner's efforts. When we think about who deserves the credit, we have more knowledge of our own contributions. Indeed, when asked to list each spouse's specific contributions to their marriage, on average, people were able to come up with 11 of their own contributions, but only 8 of their partner's contributions. When Salk claimed sole credit for the polio vaccine, he had vivid memories of the blood, sweat, and tears that he invested in developing the vaccine, but comparatively little information about his colleagues' contributions. He literally hadn't experienced what Jungner and the rest of the team did, and he wasn't present for the Nobel Prize-winning discovery that Enders, Robbins, and Weller made. Even when people are well-intentioned, writes LinkedIn founder Reid Hoffman, they tend to overvalue their own contributions and undervalue those of others. This responsibility bias is a major source of failed collaborations. Professional relationships disintegrate when entrepreneurs, inventors, investors, and executives feel that their partners are not giving them the credit they deserve or doing their fair share. In Hollywood, between 1993 and 1997 alone, more than 400 screenplays, roughly a third of all submitted, went to credit arbitration. If you're a taker, your driving motivation is to make sure you get more than you give, which means you're carefully counting every contribution that you make. It's all too easy to believe that you've done the lion's share of the work, overlooking what your colleagues contribute. George Meyer was able to overcome the responsibility bias The Simpsons has contributed many words to the English lexicon, the most famous being Homer's "Doh!" response to an event that causes mental or physical anguish. Meyer didn't invent that word, but he did coin "yoink," the familiar phrase that Simpsons characters utter when they snatch an item from another character's hands. In 2007, the humor magazine Cracked ran a feature on the top words created by The Simpsons. Making the list were classics, like cromulent, describing something that's fine, acceptable, or illegitimately legitimate, and tomaco, a crossbreed of tomato and tobacco made by Homer, first suggested in a 1959 Scientific American piece, and actually crossbred in 2003 by a Simpsons fan named Rob Bauer. But the top invented word on the list was meh, the expression of pure indifference that debuted in the sixth season of the show. In one episode, Marge Simpson is fascinated by a weaving loom at a Renaissance fair, having studied weaving in high school. She weaves a message. "Hi, Bart. I'm weaving on a loom." Bart's response, "Meh." 6 years later, an episode aired in which Lisa Simpson actually spells out the word. "Meh" has appeared in numerous dictionaries. From Macmillan, used for showing that you do not care what happens or that you are not particularly interested in something, to dictionary.com, an expression of boredom or apathy, to Collins English Dictionary, an interjection to suggest indifference or boredom, or as an adjective to say something is mediocre or a person is unimpressed. Several years ago, George Meyer was caught by surprise when a Simpsons writer shared a memory with him about an episode in which "meh" first appeared. He reminded me that I had worked on that episode, and he thought I came up with the word "meh." I didn't remember it. When I asked Tim Long who created "meh," he was pretty confident it was George Meyer. "I'm almost sure he invented meh. It's everywhere. Most people don't even realize it started with The Simpsons." Eventually, conversations with writers jogged Meyer's memory. "I was trying to think of a word that would be the easiest word to say with minimal effort. Just a parting of the lips and air would come out." Why didn't Meyer have a better memory of his contributions? As a giver, his focus was on achieving a collective result that entertained others, not on claiming personal responsibility for that result. He would suggest as many lines, jokes, and words as possible, letting others run with them and incorporate them into their scripts. His attention centered on improving the overall quality of the script, rather than on tracking who was responsible for it. A lot of the stuff is just like a basketball assist, when somebody would say, "George, that was yours." "I genuinely did not know," Meyer says. "I tended to not be able to remember the stuff that I'd done. So I wasn't always saying when I did this and that. I was saying when we did this and that. I think it's good to get into the habit of doing that." Research shows that it's not terribly difficult for matchers and takers to develop this habit. Recall that the responsibility bias occurs because we have more information about our own contributions than others. The key to balancing our responsibility judgments is to focus our attention on what others have contributed. All you need to do is make a list of what your partner contributes before you estimate your own contribution. Studies indicate that when employees think about how much help they receive from their bosses before thinking about how much they contribute to their bosses, their estimates of their bosses' contributions double, from under 17% to over 33%. Bring together a work group of 3 to 6 people and ask each member to estimate the percentage of the total work that he or she does. Add up their estimates, and the average total is over 140%. Ask them to reflect on each member's contributions before their own, and the average total drops to 123%. Givers like Meyer do this naturally, They take care to recognize what other people contribute. In one study, psychologist Michael McCall asked people to fill out a survey measuring whether they were givers or takers, and to make decisions in pairs about the importance of different items for surviving in the desert. He randomly told half of the pairs that they failed, and the other half that they succeeded. The takers blamed their partners for failures and claimed credit for successes. The givers shouldered the blame for failures and gave their partners more credit for successes. This is George Meyer's modus operandi. He's incredibly tough on himself when things go badly, but quick to congratulate others when things go well. Bad comedy hurts George physically, Tim Long says. Meyer wants each joke to make people laugh, and many to make them think. Although he holds other people to the same high standards that he sets for himself, he's more forgiving of their mistakes. Early in his career, Meyer was fired from a show called Not Necessarily the News after 6 weeks. 20 years later, he ran into the boss who fired him. She apologized. Firing him was clearly a mistake, and braced herself for Meyer to be angry. As he shared the story with me, Meyer laughed. It was just lovely to see her again. I said, "Come on, look where we all are. All is forgiven." There are a few people in Hollywood who thrive on driving their enemies' faces into the dirt. That's such a hollow motivation. And you don't want to have all these people out there trying to undermine you. In the Simpsons rewrite room, being more forgiving of others than of himself helped Meyer get the best ideas out of others. I tried to create a climate in the room where everybody feels that they can contribute, that it's okay to fall on your face many, many times, he says. This is known as psychological safety, the belief that you can take a risk without being penalized or punished. Research by Harvard Business School professor Amy Edmondson shows that in the type of psychologically safe environment that Meyer helped create, people learn and innovate more. And it's givers who often create such an environment. In one study, engineers who shared ideas without expecting anything in return were more likely to play a major role in innovation, as they made it safe to exchange information. Don Payne recalls that when he and fellow writer John Frink joined The Simpsons, they were intimidated by the talented veterans on the show. But Meyer made it safe to present their ideas. George was incredibly supportive, and he took us under his wing. He made it very easy to join in and participate, encouraged us to pitch, and didn't denigrate us. He listened and asked for our opinions. When revising scripts, many comedy writers cut material ruthlessly, leaving the people who wrote that material psychologically wounded. Meyer, on the other hand, says he tried to specialize in the emotional support of other people. When writers were freaking out about their scripts being rewritten, he was often the one to console them and calm them down. "I was always dealing with people in extremis. I would often talk people down from panic," Meyer observes. "I got good at soothing them and showing them a different way to look at the situation." At the end of the day, even if he was trashing their work, they knew he cared about them as people. Carolyn Omine comments that George does not mince words. He'll come right out and tell you if he thinks the joke you pitched is dumb, but you never feel he's saying you're dumb. Tim Long told me that when you give Meyer a script to read, it's as if you just handed him a baby, and it's his responsibility to tell you if your baby's sick. He really cares about great writing and about you. The perspective gap. If overcoming the responsibility bias gives us a clearer understanding of others' contributions, what is it that allows us to offer support to colleagues in collaborations where emotions can run high and people often take criticism personally? Sharing credit is only one piece of successful group work. Myers related abilities to console fellow writers when their work was being cut and to create a psychologically safe environment are a hallmark of another important step that givers take in collaboration: seeing beyond the perspective gap. In an experiment led by Northwestern University psychologist Lauren Nordgren, people predicted how painful it would be to sit in a freezing room for 5 hours. They made their predictions under two different conditions, warm and cold. When the warm group estimated how much pain they would experience in the freezing room, they had an arm in a bucket of warm water. The cold group also made their judgments with an arm in a bucket, but it was filled with ice water. Which group would expect to feel the most pain in the freezing room? As you probably guessed, it was the cold group. People anticipated that the freezing room would be 14% more painful when they had their arm in a bucket of ice water than a bucket of warm water. After literally feeling the cold for a minute, they knew several hours would be awful. But there was a third group of people who experienced cold under different circumstances. They stuck an arm in a bucket of ice water, but then took the arm out and filled out a separate questionnaire. After 10 minutes had passed, they estimated how painful the freezing room would be. Their predictions should have resembled the cold groups, having felt the freezing temperature just 10 minutes earlier. But they didn't. They were identical to the warm group, even though they had felt the cold 10 minutes earlier. Once they weren't cold anymore, they could no longer imagine it. This is a perspective gap. When we're not experiencing a psychologically or physically intense state, we dramatically underestimate how much it will affect us. For instance, evidence shows that physicians consistently think their patients are feeling less pain than they actually are. Without being in a state of pain themselves, physicians can't fully realize what it's like to be in that state. In a San Francisco hospital, a respected oncologist was concerned about a patient. He's not as mentally clear as he was yesterday. The patient was old, and he had advanced metastatic cancer. The oncologist decided to order a spinal tap to see what was wrong, in the hopes of prolonging the patient's life. Maybe he has an infection, meningitis, a brain abscess, something treatable. The neurologist on call, Robert Burton, had his doubts. The patient's prognosis was grim, and the spinal tap would be extremely painful. But the oncologist was not ready to throw in the towel. When Burton entered the room with the spinal tap tray, the patient's family protested, "Please, no more," they said together. The patient, too frail to speak from a terminal illness, nodded, declining the spinal tap. Burton paged the oncologist and explained the family's wishes to avoid the spinal tap, but the oncologist was not ready to give up. Finally, the patient's wife grabbed Burton's arm, begging him for support in refusing the oncologist's plan to do the spinal tap. "It's not what we want," the wife pleaded. The oncologist was still determined to save the patient. He explained why the spinal tap was essential, and eventually, the family and patient gave in. Burton performed the spinal tap, which was challenging to carry out and quite painful for the patient. The patient developed a pounding headache, fell into a coma, and died 3 days later due to the cancer. Although the oncologist was a prominent expert in his field, Burton remembers him mainly for what he taught me about uncritical acceptance, of believing that you are doing good. The only way you can really know is if you ask the patient and you have a dialogue. In collaborations, takers rarely cross this perspective gap. They're so focused on their own viewpoints that they never end up seeing how others are reacting to their ideas and feedback. On the other hand, researcher Jim Barry and I discovered that in creative work, givers are motivated to benefit others. So they find ways to put themselves in other people's shoes. When George Meyer was editing the work of Simpsons animators and writers, He was facing a perspective gap. He was cutting their favorite scenes and jokes, not his own. Recognizing that he couldn't literally feel what they were feeling, he found a close substitute. He reflected on what it felt like to receive feedback and have his work revised when he was in their positions. When he joined The Simpsons in 1989, Meyer had written a Thanksgiving episode that included a dream sequence. He thought the sequence was hilarious, but Sam Simon, the showrunner at the time, didn't agree. When Simon cut the dream from the script, Meyer was furious. "I flipped out. I was so enraged that Sam had to send me to do another task just to get me out of the room." When criticizing and changing the work of animators and writers, Meyer would look back on this experience. "I could relate to that sense of being eviscerated when other people were rewriting their stuff," he told me. This made him more empathetic and considerate, helping other people to simmer down from intense states and accept his revisions. Like Meyer, successful givers shift their frames of reference to the recipient's perspective. For most people, this isn't the natural starting point. Consider the common dilemma of giving a gift for a wedding or a new baby's arrival. When the recipient has created a registry, do you pick something from the registry or send a unique gift? One evening, my wife was searching for a wedding gift for some friends. She decided it was more thoughtful and considerate to find something that wasn't on their registry and chose to send candlesticks, assuming that our friends would appreciate the unique gift. Personally, I was perplexed. Several years earlier, when we received wedding gifts, my wife was often disappointed when people sent unique gifts, rather than choosing items from our registry. She knew she wanted particular items, and it was quite rare for anyone to send a gift that she preferred over the one she had actually selected. Knowing that she preferred the registry gift when she was the recipient, why did she opt for a unique gift when she was in the giving role? To get to the bottom of this puzzle, researchers Francesca Gino of Harvard and Frank Flynn of Stanford examined how senders and receivers react to registry gifts and unique gifts. They found that senders consistently underestimated how much recipients appreciated registry gifts. In one experiment, they recruited 90 people to either give or receive a gift from Amazon.com. The receivers had 24 hours to create a wish list of 10 products in the price range of $20 to $30. The senders accessed the wish list and were randomly assigned to either choose a registry gift from the list or a unique gift, an idea of their own. The senders expected that the recipients would appreciate the unique gift as somewhat more thoughtful and personal. In fact, the opposite was true. The recipients reported significantly greater appreciation of the registry gifts than the unique gifts. The same patterns emerged with friends giving and receiving wedding gifts and birthday gifts. The senders preferred to give unique gifts, but the recipients actually preferred the gifts they solicited on their registries and wish lists. Why? Research shows that when we take others' perspectives, we tend to stay within our own frames of reference, asking, "How would I feel in this situation?" When we're giving a gift, we imagine the joy that we would experience in receiving the gifts that we're selecting. But this isn't the same joy that the recipient will experience, because the recipient has a different set of preferences. In the giver's role, my wife loved the candlesticks she picked out. But if our friends were enamored with those candlesticks, they would have put them on their gift registry. To effectively help colleagues, people need to step outside their own frames of reference. As George Meyer did, they need to ask, "How will the recipient feel in this situation?" This capacity to see the world from another person's perspective develops early in life. In one experiment, Berkeley psychologists Betty Repicoli and Allison Gopnik studied 14-month-old and 18-month-old toddlers. The toddlers had two bowls of food in front of them, one with goldfish crackers and one with broccoli. The toddlers tasted food from both bowls, showing a strong preference for goldfish crackers over broccoli. Then, they watched a researcher express disgust while tasting the crackers and delight while tasting the broccoli. When the researcher held out her hand and asked for some food, the toddlers had a chance to offer either the crackers